Today we're going to wrap up our study of Hebrews 11, also known as the Faith Hall of Fame. And I don't know about you, but for me, this has been a much needed reminder that faith is much more than patience. Don't we sometimes confuse the two? If I just have enough faith, I'll wait it out. Sometimes patience requires faith, but they aren't the same thing. See, these heroes that we've been looking at and we're going to look at today exercised much more than patience. They endured every kind of suffering, physical suffering, social suffering, emotional suffering from their families and so forth, just and outright persecution. Some of them endured military persecution, the war within and the war without, but still they trusted God. They saw the light at the end of the tunnel, even though they never made it out of the tunnel in their lifetimes. They kept their eye on the light and they kept their faith in the light. They still trusted God, even when they didn't see His promises fulfilled in their time, in their lives. And I think for the purpose of our discussion today, trust may be a better word than faith. Here's what I'm thinking. You know, those words are nearly interchangeable. They nearly mean the same thing. The differences are subtle. But as language has changed over time, I think our word trust better conveys what the writer meant when he used the word faith. See, trust is faith in action. Faith put to work. Sometimes faith put to the test. In fact, you might even define trust as faith at risk or faith that takes a risk. You know, every day we all exercise trust in ways that we don't realize. Ever put money in the bank? Probably most of us, and we take our paycheck down there or something, and we give it to a total stranger because we trust them to keep it safe. We trust them that it'll be there when we come back to get it. Seems like there's never enough there to get back out, but that's a different story. In fact, even if the bank gets robbed or some disaster happens, then we trust in the government, the FDIC, to insure our deposits. So even if the money's not in the bank, literally, we still get it back. We don't lose it. See, we take a risk, but when we trust those people, you exercise trust every time you get in your car and drive on the public highways, don't you? I mean, you're just trusting that guy next to you to not, you know, crash into you. You're trusting the guy that's coming this way not to cross the line and smash into your car. I realized this a couple of weeks ago. It was one of those heavy rainstorms, and I'm driving down to south on I-5, and, you know, I'm racing along at the maximum allowable speed because that's what I like to do. Not above the allowable speed, but right at it. You know, I figure the speed limit really is a minimum speed. That's how I look at it anyway. And so I'm driving along, and I noticed that right next to me, I mean, this guy's, what, a foot, maybe 2 feet from me? And he's going along at as fast as the speed limit will allow. And it just kind of dawned on me, this is kind of a dangerous situation. You know, there's all around us, and we're just all racing down the road as fast as we're allowed to go, and we're just inches apart, and guys are cutting in and out and swerving and changing lanes. And by the way, when you change lanes, would you please use your turn signal? That just chaps my hide when somebody doesn't use their turn signal. That's a personal observation. But you get the idea. We are really trusting one another, and we don't intend to, we don't mean to, we don't think of it that way. Well, I'm going to get in the car and go trust everybody. But you are trusting everybody. See, where faith believes that you'll be safe in your car, trust actually gets out on the highway. Where faith believes your money is safe in the bank, it's trust that actually makes the deposit. You see the difference I'm getting at? Now, the people mentioned in this chapter are individuals who so trusted God that they put feet to their faith. They put their faith into action. They took the risk, all because they trusted God. When we do that, when we put our money in the bank, when we get in the car and the rubber hits the road, when we take that risk, see, we run the risk of being ripped off, or we run the risk of crash and burn, except that is when the one you're trusting is the Lord. The banks might fail, other drivers might make a mistake, but the Lord will never let you down when you trust Him. Here's the lesson. When you trust God, you win. When you trust yourself more than you trust God, you lose. Now that really is the heart of the gospel, coming in the back door of the gospel. When we think of the gospel, it's, I believe that Jesus died for my sin and I confess my sin, and because of His resurrection and ascension, I can count on life and eternity with Him. And that's the gospel. You know, we're all sinners. We all fall short of the glory of God. And because of what Jesus did, we have the opportunity, when we trust Him, put our faith in Him, to have that problem solved for us. Then we re-enter into a right relationship with God, justified, redeemed, sanctified, all that stuff. But when you kind of come in the back door at it, what it really amounts to is we're trusting God more than we're trusting ourselves. You know, Adam and Eve, this is where all the trouble started, right? First couple of chapters of Genesis. They trusted themselves more than they trusted God. That's how we got in this mess. They saw this fruit. It doesn't say it's an apple, although it's what it's usually represented as. They saw this fruit. And although the Lord had clearly told Adam, look, everything in this paradise is yours, but for your own good, for your own safety, and for your own protection, just stay away from this one tree. I'm not even going to put a fence around it. I'm not even going to put a barking dog or an armed guard. I'm just going to warn you. Trust me. This is a bad thing, so stay away from it. And so where's the fruit? Like a magnet, they're just drawn. And it looked good to the eye, and it seemed good to gain knowledge. And they kind of talked themselves into believing that, you know what, God really can't be trusted. I think I know what's better for me than the creator of the universe. You know, the one who designed the human eye and the intricacies of all creation. I think maybe I know better. In this case, so I'm going to trust myself, and that's what they did. They trusted themselves instead of trusting God, and here we are today in a world that's full of sin and sickness and disease and separation from God. And then, of course, Jesus comes along a few thousand years later and reversed that whole process when He trusted God the way they should have. And the result of His trusting God more than himself is now righteousness and restoration and healing and freedom from sin when we trust Him. Now, as we get started, it's important to recognize the writer's purpose in mentioning all these people. Now, he knows that the Hebrews, to whom he is writing, know these stories inside and out. Everything from, you know, from Adam and Eve to Noah's Ark to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, on down the line, Joseph, Moses, David, Solomon, the judges and the prophets. He knows that they know these. They were bedtime stories, and they were told around the dinner fire, you know, around the fire pit, Grandpa would tell us a story about Noah and the ark, you know, and then Noah had three sons, Larry, Moe, and Shep, and the kids would go, oh no, that's not right, Grandpa, and he'd go, oh, okay, I just wanted to see if you were listening. And they knew these stories, and they told these stories to their own kids, and they were telling them to their kids so they could tell them to their kids. And so the writer doesn't go into a theological, doctrinal treatise on the faith of Abraham. He just says Abraham, and they know not only who he's talking about, but what he's talking about. They know the story about leaving Ur of the Chaldees. They know about rescuing Lot from Sodom and Gomorrah. They know about him saying that his wife was his sister because he was afraid that the people would kill him. And they know all those stories. And so since it wasn't his purpose to go into every detail of every character mentioned, then I'm not going to go into detail on every character mentioned, because if we did that, not only would it take a long time, and it's a worthwhile study. I mean, if you wanted to use Hebrews 11 as a launching pad for a thorough character study of these Old Testament saints, that works really well. But his purpose wasn't to do that, and our purpose isn't to do that, because if we do, there's a real danger that we'll lose sight of the lessons that the Spirit intends for us. It's kind of that old, we might not see the forest for the trees. And this, what we have here in Hebrews 11 is a forest, not one tree at a time. We're supposed to see the big picture. And so we're going to move through these kind of quickly and stay focused, Lord willing, on the big picture. So let's start reading Hebrews 11, 17, and we're going to read to the end of the chapter and then take this apart. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "In Isaac your seed shall be called," concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they weren't afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to fight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world wasn't worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Okay. Verses 17 through 29 here highlights the Old Testament history from Abraham to Joshua. Now, we've had opportunity already to look at a couple of the details about Abraham's life and his faith. And of course, Abraham is always the starting point when you consider the things of God from a Jewish perspective, because it was Abraham whose faith was credited to him as righteousness. It was Abraham and Sarah who had no children. And in their old age, when they'd given up on having children, the Lord promised them that they would not only have children, but that their descendants would be like the sands of the seashore and the stars in the sky. And in fact, through them would come that one descendant by whom the whole world would be blessed. And it turns out that's exactly what happened, that one person being Jesus Christ. So Abram and Sarai now turn into Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham is what we call the father of our faith because he's the first one. He's the first one whose trust in God was accounted or credited or reckoned to him as righteousness. Now, what he talks about here in verses 17 through 19 is the time that Abraham offered Isaac. Now, we're not going to take time to read all these. I did, and it's worthwhile, so I encourage you to do that maybe later today or some other time on your own. But I'll just give you the passage. Abraham offering Isaac is in Genesis 22, the first half of Genesis 22. And for the sake of time, I'll just kind of tell you the story as best as I can remember it. Isaac is now somewhere in his teens. Some say 17, some say 12, 13, but he's big enough. You know, he's not a little baby anymore. This, the son of promise. He has an older brother, half brother, Ishmael, but it's Isaac that God promised would come through Abraham and Sarah. And so he's the only begotten. Notice in the text when it says only begotten that it's not hyphenated. When we read in John 3:16 that God gave his only begotten son, that is hyphenated. There are different words there in Greek, and although they read exactly the same in English, it's not the same thing. Only begotten, in this case, refers to that son of promise. We know Abraham had other children before Isaac and after Isaac. But anyway, that's the son of promise. And Abraham is instructed by the Lord. The same Lord that instructed him to leave Ur of the Chaldees and leave Haran and leave his family and go into this land I will give you without knowing where to go. And so far that was working out. There were some rough spots. There were some hills and valleys. But by and large, here was Isaac, proof positive that God's going to be faithful to his word. And now the Lord says, Abraham, take your son, your only son, your only begotten son, Isaac, to a mountain that I'll show you. And there I want you to sacrifice him. Huh? Well, wait a minute. What about descendants like stars in the sky and sand on the seashore? And Isaac hasn't married yet. There's no children. I mean, how's that going to work? I mean, you know that had to go through his mind. But Abraham, because he trusted God, said, okay, I'll do it. And they climbed up that mountain. And you know it turns out to be Mount Moriah, where Jerusalem is, where years and years later, the God's only begotten son would be sacrificed. And there's an interesting story in Genesis. They travel with some servants. They've got the wood for the fire. They've got the fire. You realize you had to carry fire with you. You know, you couldn't just, you know, you had to carry this. So they got the fire, they got the wood, and they get pretty close. And then they leave the servants behind. And Abraham says something interesting in Genesis. He says, okay, the boy and I are going to go up, and then the boy and I are going to come back down. Now, we don't know in Genesis what Abraham's thinking. He knows that they're both going to go up, and he knows that he's going to obey God and sacrifice that boy. But he also knows, in faith, that the boy and he are going to come back down. And this passage kind of clarifies that for us. Verse 19, concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead. He didn't know what God was going to do, but he figured if I kill him, God's going to have to raise him back up because I know this promise, all these promises are going to be fulfilled. And so there's the story. And they head up. And Abraham, or Isaac, I mean, he's a pretty sharp kid. He goes, well, Dad, I see the wood and I see the fire, but where's the sacrifice? You know, where's the goat? Where's the sheep? Where's the, you know, what? Did you forgot something? And Abraham says something very important. And the word order here is important in the Hebrew. He says, God will provide himself a sacrifice. Now, our Bible might say God himself will provide a sacrifice, and he did, but that God will provide himself looks forward to the cross, where God in the person of Jesus Christ goes to the cross. So anyway, they're up the mountain, and I don't know at what point, you know, Isaac sort of, you know, starts to wonder about this deal, because it says that he's got him laid out on the altar. Was he tied up? Or, I mean, he must have been tied up. He'd have got up and run away. You can't even get your kids to come and sit down for dinner. How are you going to get a kid to sit, you know, lay on the set? Or there's the wood and there's the fire and here we go. And so Abraham is just about to bring that knife down into the heart of his only begotten son. And just as he's about to do that, the angel of the Lord says, "Okay, Abraham, hold it. Now I know that you really trust me." He knew he was going to go through with it. And so he stopped him. And just then he looks over, and what do they see? But over in the bushes, there's a ram with his horns caught in a bush. And they sacrifice that ram. And they both come down the mountain. All because Abraham believed in, had faith in, trusted in the promise. Abraham, through you is going to come one who will bless the whole world. And at this point, logic and human reasoning says, well, I guess that's not going to happen. But Abraham believed God. He goes, I don't know. Even if he has to raise that boy from the dead, I know that promise is true. And that's the kind of faith, that's the kind of trust that Abraham had. Verse 20 talks now about Isaac. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Another interesting story, too long to read, and I'll try to tell this one more quickly than I told the last one. There are just so many fascinating details. You know, the twins are born to Isaac and his wife. One comes out first, you know, they come out in a certain order, so there's an older and a younger by minutes, separated by minutes, and they named them, you know, Jacob and Esau. Jacob, the supplanter, the heel snatcher. And you can read about this in Genesis chapter 27, in the last part of the chapter, verse 26 and following. That, and you may know this story, you know, Jacob is kind of a mama's boy and Esau is a manly man. Esau goes out and kills wild game, and, you know, and Jacob learns how to stay home and cook with mom, you know. And so Esau's gone, and his mom, she's kind of a schemer. I guess maybe that's where he got that heel snatcher part of his personality. But she said, you should get the birthright, not Esau. And, well, how are we going to do that? He goes, well, here's what I'll do. I'll fix your dad his favorite meal, and we'll dress you up in skins so you're kind of hairy like your brother, and you'll even smell like him, and then you go in and, you know, and get the blessing. Isaac, I forgot to say, is about to die, so he wants to give his final blessing to his two sons, and the older son gets the birthright. Well, Jacob does exactly that, and it works. Isaac gives him the blessing. And then later on, Esau comes in and he fixes some stew and he takes it in and says, well, Daddy, I'm ready for the blessing. Here's your dinner. And he says, what are you talking about? I already blessed you. I already gave the blessing. Well, that must have been Jacob. They tricked you. Can't you give me the blessing now? No, I can't. I gave it once. I can only give it once. There's no going back. And he gives this blessing to Esau that has some kind of rough spots in it. You know, your life's not going to be easy, and you're going to be hassled for most of your life, and it's not going to be pleasant. But he gives this blessing, and here's the thing. And of course, the lesson in that is that God knows what he's doing by Jacob receiving the blessing instead of Esau. But here's the thing with Isaac. In his old age, in spite of the, well, it wasn't a mix-up because it was intentional, but in spite of the sort of sneaky business that went on there, Isaac was looking forward to the promises that God gave his father Abraham. Isaac knew he was Isaac. He knew he was laughter. That's what his name means. He knew he was the son of promise, and he believed that promise every bit as much as his father Abraham, and he passed that blessing and that faith, that trust in God, on to his two sons. Now, verse 21, we follow the path now. We leave Esau behind, and we follow the path of Jacob. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on his staff. You know, Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel when he wrestled with God, has the 12 sons, the patriarchs, the 12 tribes from which every Hebrew can trace their descendancy back to. And as he dies, I mean, they skipped a lot here. You know, Joseph is sold into slavery and in prison, and then finally he ends up being like co-Pharaoh of all Egypt because the Lord gives him the gift of being able to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. And now Joseph's time is about at an end. And he asks, this is in Genesis chapter 50, verses 24 and 25. He gives instructions. He says, don't bury me here. Don't leave me here. And he doesn't get specific, but he seems to just innately understand that someday the Hebrew people are going to leave Egypt and go to the land that God promised Abraham. And so he says, when I die, don't leave my bones here. Pack me up and take me to that promised land with you. Well, it's like 400 and some odd years now. And the Hebrews become slaves of the Egyptians. And finally, Moses raises up, and we'll talk about him next. And when they finally do get ready to leave Egypt, after all that business with Pharaoh and the plagues and that whole, you know, incredible, miraculous story, they do exactly that. They gather up Joseph's 400 and some odd year remains, and they pack it up and they take it with them when they go. Now, why would Joseph do that? It's because he was aware of the promise through his dad, Jacob, who heard it from Isaac, who heard it from Abraham, that God is going to bless this family through our great-great-grandpa Abraham, and now we trace that lineage on down to our day or his day, and the promise will be fulfilled. I don't just believe it, I know it. In fact, I'm so sure of it that I'm going to make arrangements right now, 400 and some years before the fact, that when they go there, they take me with them. Faith, trusting God. Now, verses 23 through 29, we get to Moses, one of the greatest Sunday school stories of all time. How many of you made that little ark out of straws and popsicle sticks and stuff? You know, I did. I made a couple of them. My mom thought it was a shoebox, but that's because I'm not crafty. But we made them anyway. Verse 23 tells the first part of the story. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they weren't afraid of the king's command. You know the story. The Hebrews were getting, their numbers were so large that the Egyptians were afraid that there would be a slave revolt, because the slaves outnumbered the citizens. And so whenever the Hebrews have a baby, if it's a baby boy, abort it. You know, late term abortion, but same thing, just kill it. Throw it out. Very brutal stuff. If it's a girl, that's one thing, but if it's a boy, well, his parents had this beautiful baby boy, they named him Moses, and they said, we're not going to do that. And so they kind of kept him secret for the first few months. And then they looked down the waterway where Pharaoh's daughter and her entourage are bathing or doing laundry or something. And they make this little raft out of some reeds and they put the baby in it and they push him out in the water. And they're watching the whole time. And Pharaoh's daughter, not just anybody, Pharaoh's daughter finds this baby. Oh, look. I'm going to take this baby and raise it as my own. And then this is the real cool part of the story. Then Pharaoh's daughter hires Moses' real mother to be the nursemaid. So she does get to raise her own son. Isn't that great how God just kind of spun that thing around so that everybody got what they wanted and got what they needed? And now Moses is raised as a prince. This little Hebrew boy who was supposed to be thrown out with the trash is raised like a prince, but It tells us at the end of the verse, they weren't afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, this is verse 24, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God, with the Hebrews, than enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And you know this story probably. Moses is about 40, and he's tired of, well, I don't know if he's tired of it, but you know, he's pampered living as the Pharaoh's, the princess's son, you know, the Pharaoh's grandson, so to speak, grandson-in-law, step-grandson, however that works out. And he's been, you know, educated with the finest education. He eats the finest food. He wears the finest clothes. He rides around in a chariot. People carry him and where he needs to go and bring him whatever he needs. But he can't connect with those people. He's a Hebrew. He's a Jew. He's a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he knows that. And so one day he sees an Egyptian mistreating one of his people, a Hebrew slave. And Moses, I don't know if he meant to, it doesn't tell us, but he ended up killing the Egyptian. You know, pretty extreme. And then he buried the body in the sand. And he thinks he got away with it. But then some Egyptians say, we saw what you did. Are you going to kill us now? You know, are you going to kill all of us? But Moses, so related, connected, so associated himself as a Hebrew, as a descendant of Abraham and that whole patriarchal line, that he left. He walked away, ran away, really. 40 years old, ran away into the desert, has some great adventures there, which we can't go into the details about. And when he's 80 years old now, he comes back. Let my people go. And again, another long story that we can't go into now. But see, it was all because of that promise handed down. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, the 400 years of Israelis, of Hebrews, and then Moses raised in Pharaoh's own house, but still trusting the God of the Hebrews, Yahweh, made a promise, and he's going to fulfill it. And if that means I walk away from a life of luxury and put myself at risk and in danger, and if it means at the age of 80, I come back and I confront those people that used to welcome me as part of their family, and now I'm a murderer and a traitor, but I don't care. I'm going to go in there and say, let my people go. Why am I going to say it? Because that's what God told me to say. I tried to get out of it, but I don't talk very good. That's okay. Who made your mouth? I think I can handle this. Take your brother with you just in case. You know? But it's all about his trust in God, and this, the trust in God's promises. Okay, we get then to verse 28. By faith, 27, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. It's a hint. Now, maybe Moses didn't know exactly what he was looking for, but he knew there was one coming, because God had promised Abraham, through you will come the one who will bless the whole world. And here it says that Moses saw him somehow, who is invisible, you know, knew he was coming, trusted God. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. The Passover, you know, it was the final straw. Let my people go. No. Let my people go. No. Have some frogs, have some flies, have some blood, have some of this, have some boils, you know, have these plagues. And no, I'm not letting them go. And then finally, the Passover, where the angel of death is going to come through and take the firstborn of every family, even of the animals, except those who slaughter an innocent lamb and sprinkle the blood of that lamb over their doorpost. And then when the angel comes through, he will pass over those people. Those people who put their faith in the blood of an innocent lamb. Exodus 14, we read about them marching through the Red Sea. Now, estimates vary here on the number of Israelites that came out. And remember, it was a mixed multitude. So you've got all the Hebrews and a good number of non-Hebrews who kind of went along with this deal. And some estimates go as high as 6 million people. That's a lot of people. Half of that is a lot of people. And I don't know about that. I can't verify the numbers, but it's a lot of folks. And the Lord says, finally, there's this Passover, and the Pharaoh says, not only can you go, but now I'm kicking you out. Get out of here. And here, take some gold with you. You know, and they set off, and he said, the Lord said, no, I want you to camp across the water from this temple of Baal. Across from this temple of false idol worship. And it's significant because it's right across from that temple that the Lord then parts the water, just like in the Charlton Heston movie. Probably even better than that. Parts the water. The wind blows the land, the ground dry, so they don't even have to walk through in the mud. They walk across on dry land, and when they get across, they look back, and here, look, Pharaoh has changed his mind, and he's coming to get them and bring them back. And his army gets out in the middle of there where the water's parted, and the water comes back down and drowns them. Moses crossed that Red Sea, even with the Egyptian army behind him, because he trusted God. I don't know how he's going to work out. He didn't know the water was going to come down. He didn't know the water was going to part for him. He just knew that God told him to go out and camp right here and then do what, you know, what the Lord shows you to do next. And that's what he did. And the Lord showed him. And then the Lord wiped out the Egyptians, because Moses knew, he trusted that God was going to be faithful to his promise. Which takes us down now in verse 31 to Rahab, or Rahab is probably the right way to say it. By faith, the harlot, and by the way, harlot here doesn't necessarily mean prostitute. This is a word for innkeeper. She could have just ran a bed and breakfast. You know, emphasis on the breakfast, not the bed. You know what I mean? By faith, she did not perish with those who didn't believe when she had received the spies with peace. And there's a long story there we won't get into. Read in Joshua chapter 2, where the spies with Joshua have gone into Jericho to kind of check things out, and they have to be hidden from the people of Jericho. Jerichoans, I don't know what you call those guys, Jerichoites. And this innkeeper, this woman, hides them. And she says, there's just, you know, here's the deal, here's the contract. I'll hide you now, and when you people, under the authority of your God, who she trusted in, the God of the Jews, when you come and conquer this place, save me. And then you get up to Joshua chapter 6, and that's exactly what happened. All that business with the purple thread and stuff. Fascinating story. But here, even Rahab, or Rahab, or however you want to say it, even she trusted in this God of the Jews to fulfill his promise, so much so that she risked her life, her very life. She risked it twice. She risked it once when she hid those guys, because if they would have been found out, they would have killed her. And she risked it again when the Israelites did come back and march around Jericho until the walls fell down. And she trusted in the Lord that she wouldn't perish in that conquest as well. Their faith, here's kind of a wrap-up of this section. Their faith required more than patience. It required endurance. And here's the difference. Let me kind of illustrate this, paint a picture of this. You know what it's like when you go to the doctor for a checkup? It's just time for your annual checkup or whatever. And, you know, doctors, bless their hearts, they're always late. They're always running behind schedule. So your appointment's at 11:30, and you show up at 11:20, and you check in, and at 11:45, you're still sitting there. You've read all the amusing anecdotes in Reader's Digest, and I don't like hunting fish in Field and Stream, so I don't even look at that one. You're counting the dots in the ceiling. It's 11:50, 12:05. Finally, they come out and call you in for your 11:30 appointment, right? Then you wait in another room until the doctor anyway. That's patience. That's patience. You just wait. You're kind of maybe a little flustered, and you know nobody likes to be kept waiting, but you just kind of wait it out. It's part of life, right? But if you hurt yourself, I mean, you need to go to the emergency room. I need help right now. And if you live here, it's a half-hour drive to the emergency room. You better hope you don't bleed to death or something in the meantime, or go into shock. And finally you get there and they take a look at you and you're hurting. Maybe you cut yourself or broke an arm or something, and you're just, it hurts, man. And you finally get to the emergency room, and then they tell you, well, have a seat. We'll be right with you. Have a seat? I'm ready to get in the helicopter now. You know, I want to go. Where's the x-ray machine? I'll run it myself. Let's just do something. But no, just, and see, that's endurance. You see the difference? One just takes patience and you just kind of kill time. The other one, man, you're suffering. There's some pain involved here and you have to endure that until you get the help. See, these people endured. They didn't just wait patiently. They endured. Has your faith ever led you into a situation that required endurance? Think for a minute. Think back over your time with the Lord. Has your faith, has your trust in the Lord ever led you into a situation that required endurance? Because of your faith, have you ever been asked to give up something that's dear to you, the way Abraham was? Have you ever been scorned like Noah? Have you ever had to give up a comfortable situation? Have you ever put your comfort and your happiness at risk in such a way that only God could protect you? Now, if the answer is no, then you might need to ask yourself, is my faith more than an opinion? Is my faith just the way I feel? You know, I feel that God is real, and I, you know, is it just an opinion or a feeling? Or is your faith an unshakable conviction that's put into action, that's put to the test, the way these people's faith was put to the test? See, these folks, they were ordinary folks. Read their stories. They were weak. They suffered failure. They struggled with the same things that we do and more. They didn't just think a certain way about God and call that faith. See, faith doesn't play it safe. Faith takes a risk, knowing that when you trust God, you win. In verses 32 through 38, there are more highlights, more heroes, and he didn't go into detail, so I won't, and we already read them, but you can see this list of names that he mentions here. Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, and so forth and so on. And he names this, delineates, you know, this list of sufferings and challenges and tests and trials that all these people's trust in God saw them through. And then he gets down to verse 39 to wrap it up. He says, and all of these, from where we started back in the first part of the chapter, from Cain, Noah, and Abraham, and on down the list, all of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, you know, their faith was proven, their reputation was solid through their faith, they didn't receive the promise. None of them. None of them. Noah built an ark, survived a flood, established a new civilization, and then he died. He never saw Abraham. Died. Never saw it. Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses. Moses didn't even get to go into the promised land. He died in the desert. But they still trusted. And verse 40 here puts the cap on it. God, having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Now, this is where the King James takes the truth and ties it up in a nice grammatical knot that it takes a lot of work to untangle. Let me just rephrase this verse for you. He's talking about these heroes of the faith, and what he says is here, they won't see the promise fulfilled until we all see it. Think about that. Your faith, my faith, clinging to the promises of God in face of every struggle and every trial and every challenge. And then on that day, when God says, okay, now's the time, we see the fulfillment But same time Abraham sees it, Moses sees it. We're all in this together. Man, I got to tell you, that excites me. Your trust in the Lord. You ever put it to work? You ever put it to the test? You ever take a chance on something that you know, and that's important, but that you know is of the Lord, where you really stick your neck out, and if this doesn't work out, it's not going to be good. There's a serious downside, but I trust the Lord, and so I'm going to do it. I'm going to move forward into it. Imagine what your life would be like. You put your faith to work. You put your faith into action. And guess what? God comes through. He always comes through. When you trust God, you win. When you trust yourself, you lose. You can count on that. So you trust God and you win. And then the next time, God says, this is going to take a leap of faith to stick your neck out. Say, hey, been there, done that. No problem. And you do, and you win. You trust God, and you win. Now, if you do that, and 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 I do that, and we all do that, then imagine how we can change our little corner of the world here on Spirit Lake Highway. A bunch of people whose faith isn't just a feeling, but it's trust, faith in action. See, you can trust the Lord every time, in every way. So it's just up to you to actually do that.